Well, I'm delighted that you're all here. My colleague Ibrahim Aburabi, who's the ECMC chair in Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta, the two of us have been doing some thinking about Islam and Christianity and modern culture and the whole range of issues associated with that in our world today. And we're particularly delighted that Dr. Mumtaz Ahmed is with us tonight and is going to be with us tomorrow at the session at Trinity Lutheran Church in Edmonton in the afternoon from 1 until 5, where we are doing the first of a series of sessions. This particular session tomorrow is called Islam for Christians. We will be doing a session in the fall, Christianity for Muslims, in a mosque in Edmonton, as well as a number of other things. There is a connection between this wonderful scholar who has come to be with us this evening and Augustana. And that connection is Martin Marty, the great Lutheran scholar at the University of Chicago that has given the Augustana Distinguished Lectures here in the past. And Martin Marty, who I have often said has not had an unpublished word. And it got a smile from our colleague when I said this on the way down. Dr. Ahmed worked with Martin Marty on the Fundamentalist Project, the huge five-volume work that was produced examining the development of fundamentalism in all the great religions of the world in many and varied contexts. So I know his work from that particular set of volumes, and I was delighted when Ibrahim suggested that now was the hour to bring him, that he was able to come. So Dr. Ahmed is professor of political science at Hampton University in Virginia and the executive director of the Iqbal International Institute for Research and Dialogue, which was established a few years back at the International Islamic University in Islamabad. And he's been in Islamabad for most of this year, but has been back in Hampton recently, which is why he can be with us tonight. He's also the current president of the South Asian Muslim Studies Association and the vice president of the Center of Islam and Public Policy in Washington, D.C. His area of academic and research interest is broad and varied. He has been working on comparative politics in the Near East and South Asia. Our colleague Ibrahim, he is another one of these remarkable scholars with extraordinary reach in our world. He's also been working on the United States of America and the Islamic world, on Islamic political thought and institutions, comparative politics of contemporary Islamic movements, and politics and sociology, most recently in the madrasa system of education in Pakistan. So I'm delighted that you're with us tonight and that you can spend this time both this evening and then on the weekend and into next week with us here in the Great Plains of Canada. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much, David, for your very kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here with all of you, and I really appreciate all of you coming here, particularly on Friday evening, and as you said, the rush hour in this city. I was in Islamabad. In Islamabad, the rush hour is the one when you have a bomb blast. And there have been many bomb blasts last year when I was there, unfortunately. He also mentioned I'm here on a very particularly important day for Muslims, Friday, then tomorrow, Sabbath day for Jews, and then on Sunday, Christians. So I will share all the three holidays with my Semitic brothers and sisters. But I remember my son, Junaid, he missed many Friday prayers because he was in public school and there was no... And one day he asked me, he said, "Dad, why can't we have Friday prayers on Sunday? Because that's the way when we have holiday. I mean, in the United States of America, we cannot have the same kind of Islam that we had back in Pakistan, because I cannot attend the Friday prayer. So why can't we have Friday prayers on Sunday? That's the way many of us want to pray." I will not be very structured in terms of my presentation because there are so many things I have been asked by Ibrahim to speak on. And if you see any incoherence in my presentation, please blame him. He's responsible. He has been sending a lot of misleading emails to me, asking me to do this, do that, into mother's education, Islam in state in Pakistan, religion in public life in South Asia, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Bush, Obama, everything under the sun.
We brought our sleeping bags, don't worry.
Exactly, so please excuse my unstructured, incoherent remarks, and you know how to blame. But I had to be very careful because in the United States, when you stand up and speak, you said American foreign policy is bad, American foreign policy is doing this thing to the rest of the world, and America is responsible for that. I did the same thing when I was in Toronto, and I started talking about criticizing American foreign policy and how it has adversely affected the rest of the world. And then somebody stood up and said, "Dr. Ahmed, be careful, you are in Canada." Say the United States foreign policy, not American foreign policy. We are also America, and we are not responsible for what is happening in the rest of the world. So, ladies and gentlemen, I absolve you of all the sins committed by my country in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and everywhere in the world. So, you can listen to me without any guilt and with easy conscience. Islam, basically, if you look at South Asia predominantly means India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. When I was at the University of Chicago, where David was there, they had a program in South Asian studies. And in South Asian studies, they had 98% India, 1.5% Pakistan, and then 0.05% Bangladesh. That was South Asia for them. So for the even in the United States, in American universities, South Asia means India. But coming from Pakistan, South Asia, for me, means Pakistan. Religion is very important for most South Asian people. There was one Harvard sociologist probably who said that India is the most religious society on the face of the earth. And it's true. More than Pakistan. Although Pakistan is associated with most of religious activism, jihadism, Talibanism, religious militancy. And you hear about Pakistan being deeply Islamic, deeply religious. But if you look at the society in general, India is probably the most deeply religious society in the world. And as they say, Sweden, any Swede here? Sweden is considered the most secular state in the world. And somebody remarked, the country I come from, United States of America, somebody said that America is a society of Indians ruled by Sweden. That's probably the case. Anyway, religion is very important for the lives of the people in South Asia, not only in India, but in Pakistan as well as in Bangladesh. India constitutionally is a secular state. The Indian constitution very clearly says that India is a secular state. In other words, the state will not discriminate against any religious community. As far as the state is concerned, all religions are equal. Bangladesh, when it was established in 1971, December 1971, when it separated from Pakistan, it also began its independent career as a secular state. But later on, in 1976, its constitution was amended, and at least nominally, the constitution says that Islam is the state religion of Bangladesh. As far as Pakistan is concerned, it has been an Islamic state, quote-unquote, from its very inception in 1947. In fact, the very raison d'etre of the Pakistani state, according to the popular perceptions of the Pakistani, is that it came into being in the name of Islam. The Muslims in South Asia, in British India, they were living, when the British were planning to leave and give independence to India, the Muslim community of many the Indian provinces, they did not feel comfortable with the prospects of living as a minority in an independent India. Therefore, overwhelming majority of the Muslims demanded a separate state of their own where they can live their life and, quote-unquote, practice their religion according to their own wishes and understanding. So there is a built-in structured relationship between Islam and the state in Pakistan. This is something that is a structural constraint or structural opportunity for the people of Pakistan. Therefore, the relationship between Islam and the state is almost inherent. It's a given kind of thing. That is what gives the legitimacy to the Islamic political parties to operate in the name of Islam in the political process. Because the state is an Islamic state, and in the popular perception of the people, the state of Pakistan was created in the name of Islam, therefore it's quite legitimate for the people of Pakistan to demand that the state incorporates in its policies the teachings of Islam or the injunctions of Islam. Islam became integral to the politics of Pakistan for several reasons. One reason I already indicated, that constitutionally Islam is the religion of the state. But the second reason was that when Pakistan came into being, it consisted of several regions, several linguistic groups. There were Punjabis who lived in Punjab, they spoke Punjabi. There were Sindhis, there were Baloch, there were Pashtuns in Northwest Frontier Province, and then there were Bengalis in East Pakistan. It was believed, it was considered by the state authorities that in the presence of such diversity, where you have different linguistic groups, different regions, different cultures, it is only Islam that can unite all the different regions and cultures and linguistic groups. Hence, the state, by force, had to use Islam as a force of national unity. Obviously, it didn't work because in 1971, when the civil war broke out, and the Bengalis, who were as good Muslims as the West Pakistanis were, they demanded a separate state of their own. It obviously meant that Islam alone was not enough to unite the nation. It had to be supplemented by some other, by economic initiatives, by political initiatives, by giving them equal opportunity of participation in the political process of Pakistan, or by giving them equal access to the national resources. That did not happen. So the 1971 separation of East Pakistan was a testimony to the fact that Islam may be and could be a necessary factor in national unity, but not sufficient factor. It had to be supplemented by other factors which the Pakistani state did not do. After the separation of East Pakistan, then the state of Pakistan became much more concerned about the unity of the rest of the country, which is the West Pakistan, consisting of the four regional or ethnic groups, the Punjabis, the Sindhis, the Baloch, and the Pashtuns. Hence, when Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto took over in 1972 as the new Prime Minister of Pakistan, the remaining Pakistan, his emphasis on Islam increased rather than decreased. Being a very secular person, self-proclaimed socialist, educated at Berkeley and probably at Oxford somewhere, in England somewhere, and a very secular person, he was the first one to incorporate Islam in public policy. Many people, most observers of the Pakistani politics in the United States and elsewhere, they identify General Ziaul Haq as the harbinger of Islamization in Pakistan. I think it needs to be corrected and said that it was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the secular, the socialist, who was the founding father of state-sponsored Islamization and not Ziaul Haq. Ziaul Haq was Bhutto's child in that particular sense. He continued the policies. It was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto who declared the Ahmadis as non-Muslims, amending the constitution. It was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto who banned the alcoholic drinks and gambling and all the other kind of some symbolic gestures to appease the religious leaders. After Zulfikar Ali Bhutto came President General Ziaul Haq as a result of the military coup. So most of the Islamization measures that are identified with Pakistan were introduced during General Ziaul Haq's period. It was during his time that the criminal law was amended and the Hudud laws, that is the Islamic penal laws, were introduced as a part of the Pakistani legal system. For example, the punishment for the fornication, for adultery, for drinking alcohol, for theft and stealing, all those the Islamic penal laws, cutting of hands, or all. Of course, not a single hand was cut in Pakistan. No, you won't see anyone with one hand in Pakistan. That's why I was in Chicago at that time when this law, the Islamic penal law was introduced, and a friend of mine who was studying economics at the University of Chicago, he said, after the introduction of these Islamic laws, you won't have any economists in Pakistan. I said, why? He said, because the economists are always fond of saying, on the one hand and on the other. And there won't be another hand. Anyway, the law was written in the book, but let me assure you, not a single hand has been chopped in Pakistan, thanks to judges like Mr. Sayyid here. Anyway, but it was also during Ziaul Haq's time that compulsory collection by the state of the Islamic charitable giving was introduced. That is, the zakat, the 2.5% of your annual wealth. The state started appropriating compulsory collection of that charitable funds. Interestingly, when this law was passed, that every if you have a bank account, at the end of the year, the bank will automatically deduct 2.5% of all your saving accounts and transfer it to the central treasury as your contribution to the religious charity, which is zakat. The Shias of Pakistan, Shia is a minority sect within Islam, almost about 10, 12 to 15% of the Pakistanis are Shia. The Shia ulama, the religious clergy, they protested. They said, according to the Shia religious jurisprudence, they are not supposed to give their zakat, their charity, to the state. They have only to give it to their own religious leaders. President Zia resisted, but then the Shia community, I think they besieged Islamabad capital. I mean, they rushed to Islamabad, and they besieged the central secretariat. Ultimately, President Zia had to give it, and the exemption was given to the Shias. The next day, the percentage of Shia population doubled. So, we have two kinds of Shias in Pakistan.
Tax Shias and non-tax.
The real Shias and the Zakati Shias. Actually, my sister-in-law also filed a kind of exemption. She said, Shia. I know she's not Shia. Anyway, so some of the other symbolic measures were taken by President Ziaul-Haq for Islam, for example, establishment of this university with which I am associated, International Islamic University in Islamabad, holding international conferences, and a lot of other things. After Ziaul-Haq's death in the plane crash, this is another Pakistani tragedy. Most of the time when Pakistan hits the international headlines, it is always when there is a military coup, which takes place quite often, or when a plane crash and the president is killed in the plane crash, when there is an earthquake, when there is a bomb blast. So these are the times when the international community is attentive to Pakistan. Otherwise, some of the good things, positive things that happen quietly in the country, nobody pays attention. Anyway, when President Ziaul-Haq died in plane crash, after that, Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, may God rest her soul, she took over as the new ruler, the chief executive of Pakistan. Now, here was a woman who was educated in Oxford and at Harvard, and supposed to be very highly enlightened. She described herself as daughter of the East in the autobiography that she wrote, but she was very highly westernized and highly secular in terms of orientation. Here was an opportunity for her to at least amend, if not repeal, the laws which were oppressive in many cases, particularly against women. But she didn't do it. She didn't do it. Not only that, in our most recent book that was published after her death, what was the name? Reconciliation. She talks about against the Taliban and the rise of the Taliban and the militancy. Many of you will be shocked to know, as remember that I'm shocked to know that the gambling is going on in Casablanca, that it was Benazir Bhutto who recognized the Taliban government. There were only three countries in the entire world that recognized the Taliban as a legitimate government: Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the first was Pakistan under the leadership of Oxford and Harvard educated Benazir Bhutto. In fact, when her government, she played a kind of the Harvard card again and again in Pakistan just to impress the people, although I know Harvard is not, David and I know University of Chicago is much better than anyway, okay, but I remember in 1990 when the first time her government was dismissed by the president of the charges of corruption, I was in Washington, D.C. I received a phone call from CBS Radio. They said they want to interview me. I said, why? What happened? I'm scared. Another plane crash, another president. He said, no. The Prime Minister of Pakistan has been dismissed. I said, I didn't hear the news. And the guy who was calling me from CBS, he said, we're going on air in about 10 minutes. And what I'm going to do is, those were not the days of the internet and all these things. He said, I read to you on telephone the wire service news story, and then we'll go on air and we want your contacts, your comments. And then somebody read me the story that the president of Pakistan, Mr. Ghulam Isaak Khan, dismissed the government of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto on the charges of corruption and on the charges of inefficiency, etc. And then immediately, then the news started, 5 o'clock news, and the news anchor, he started asking the question. He said, Dr. Ahmed, as you know, the government of...
As you well know.
Exactly. The Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto's government has been dismissed. Why it was dismissed? I said, I understand her government was dismissed on the charges of corruption. And now, like a good American, he said, but she's a Harvard graduate. See the correction. I said, she was dismissed on the charges of corruption. And his immediate response was, but she's a Harvard graduate. And I said, do you think only Yale graduates are corrupt? Remember, at that time the president, Bush, Senior, was a Yale graduate. So. Anyway, so it's not only the Yale graduate, the Harvard graduate. Only the University of Chicago graduates are honest men and women of integrity, as you well know. Since then, there has been a steady kind of degenerative kind of, what's it called? I'm reading P.D. James novel, Black Tower. I brought it with me. And it's a beautiful novel. You must read that. She's my favorite, what's called the detective writer. And she talks about an asylum where people have progressive degenerative disease. So that's when you have the progressive degenerative kind of process started in the Pakistani body politic. And now, today, we have a situation in which there's complete collapse of law and order in the northern areas of Pakistan. North Waziristan, South Waziristan have almost been appropriated, controlled by the people known as the Pakistani Taliban, the militants. There's a crisis of governance. There's a crisis of the lack of law and order, lack of security, and all these things. However, there are some good things happening in the country. You must have read recently, there was a very popular grassroots movement in order to restore the judges who were dismissed by President General Musharraf in 2007. That movement was launched by the lawyers, by the legal community, by his brothers and sister. And that movement became a grassroots movement supported by the ordinary people, by the civil society, and it became so powerful that in 2008 President Musharraf had to resign, and after that when President Zardari, the former husband, what we called the happy widower, husband of Benazir Bhutto. Yeah. When Benazir Bhutto was the Prime Minister and he was the first spouse, I was talking to David, he was known as Mr. 10%, because every contract, government contract, he had a commission, 10% allocated to him. Now he's the President, he's known as Mr. 70%. And recently, when last week when President Obama announced economic aid to Pakistan, he said that we will provide $1.5 billion to Pakistan. The comment in Pakistani media was that $1 billion is for Zardari and $0.5 billion is for Pakistan. And President Obama will transfer the $1 billion directly to his account, personal account. This is the kind of leadership that we have. Corrupt, inept, inefficient, and undecided. This is one of the reasons why the militancy has not been able, it has not been controlled so far. There are other reasons also. Let's talk about my country. What has been the contribution of the United States? When the United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001, November, after the tragic events of 9/11, it was probably, there was no thinking and no strategic planning done. What will happen after the US troops go there and finish the Taliban? absolutely there was no future planning. Nobody thought about it. The idea was, let's go there. It's a kind of spirit of revenge and vengeance. You just wanted to hit somebody. In fact, at that time, Bob Woodward reports that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was a little reluctant in invading Afghanistan, not because he had some moral qualms about it, but he thought there is nothing to hit there. He said there are no appropriate targets there. That's why they decided to invade Iraq. You see, because Iraq had good targets. There was electrical system, there was a water system, there was educational institutions, there were big government buildings and big projects and big dams and rivers and bridges. So you could enjoy throwing bomb there. In Afghanistan, they said we'll put Afghanistan into the Stone Age. Some Afghans said, but we are already in the Stone Age. There was nothing in it. Anyway, when the United States went there, what did they do? How many troops did they send? About 30,000. Can you defeat or conquer a country with 30,000 troops? No. And almost all of them, 30,000 troops, now it appears, if you look at the Rick's, Mr. Rick's book about Gamble and some of the other books that have now appeared, only about 500 to 600 Americans actually participated in the war. The rest of the war was subcontracted, outsourced to the Northern Alliance. They were the ones who were given suitcases full of US dollars. Said, here is the money, go fight for us. What did those warlords of Northern Alliance did? They took the suitcase full of dollars from the American generals, and then they took the same amount of money from Al-Qaeda and let them go. They were charged with the responsibility by the American leadership to go and pursue and chase and capture Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. Now, if you are the person who is being given money by the US generals, here is, I'll give you, let's say, $5 million every month if you can continue to capture the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Would you capture all of them at one time?
Obviously not.
Would you destroy the prospects of your permanent income every month? No. So that's what happened. These Northern Alliance people and also the Pakistani military under the leadership of General Zia, they did the same thing. They would get $10 million and the Pakistan army used to get about $500 million a month at that time in the early phase to fight against Al-Qaeda. But Musharraf was smart. He knew if he captures all the Taliban and all the Al-Qaeda leaders and delivers to the United States, that would be the end of his income. So what did he do? He delivered one Taliban a week, one Al-Qaeda a month, in order to ensure to be paid continuously for the rest of decades and decades. That's why you still have the Taliban, you still have Al-Qaeda people running around. Most of the warlords who were subcontracted to fight against the Taliban, they are good Afghans. And the good Afghan is, they say, Afghan or Pashtun can never be bought. But then they say, he can be rented. So, and he can be rented by both sides. Many of those warlords who have been and still continue to receive funds from the United States, they also get the same amount of money from the Al-Qaeda and from the Taliban, and they let them go. You remember Tora Bora? They said, Osama bin Laden disappeared in Tora Bora. And the U.S., until now, the U.S. is not willing to fight. President Obama recently announced that he's going to send 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Now, a reasonable estimate given by the Center for American Security Policy, Center for American Security, yes, is that if you want to fight the Taliban and defeat them, you need at least 250,000 troops. 250,000 troops. The current level of the American troops is 30,000. You send 17,000 more. And remember, those 70,000 are not going to be the fighting troops, all of them. That's a drop in the bucket. You're talking about a huge country, very difficult terrain. What's happening? Most of the Taliban, when they feel pressure, they cross the border into Pakistan, in the northern territories. North Waziristan, South Waziristan. The border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is not a border like the border between any two countries. It's more porous than the Canadian-American border. At least they asked me for my documents here. Afghanistan-Pakistan border, there's Ms. Sayed knows, we call it a Dhaka passport. Dhaka, you know, push. You show yourself up at the border, and if you are crossing from Pakistan, the Pakistani border policeman, he will push you. You only need push passport to push you. Coming from the Afghan side, he'll push you in towards the Pakistan side. No passport, no document is required. The reason is that the line that divides Afghanistan and Pakistan is an artificial line. It was drawn by the British. Let's blame the British. Durand line in the early 20th century. And the Afghans and the Pakistani tribes have not so far accepted that Durand line. Yes. The most important thing is, even during the Taliban regime, which was the most supportive of the Pakistanis, they did not recognize the Durand line separating the two countries. And even Karzai's government today is not does not consider this line border between Pakistan and Afghanistan as legitimate. So how come President Karzai then complains that the Pakistan allows its militants to cross the border? Because there is no border. Most of the tribes that live on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan are the same tribes. Half of the tribe lives on the Afghan side, half of the tribe on the Pakistan side. They consider it as their moral and birthright to visit their families across the border. And historically, whenever one part of the tribe was under pressure by a foreign power or by some domestic enemy, the other part of the tribe would join to help them. It's quite natural, understandable. In Afghanistan, let's admit it, there is a foreign occupation force. America is occupying Afghanistan along with the NATO forces. The Afghans, and particularly the Pashtuns, they consider it as their legitimate right to resist the foreign occupation. And the Pakistani part of their tribal brothers, they consider as their duty to help them in their resistance against foreign occupation. As simple as that. There are elements of Al-Qaeda there, that's true. There are Chechens, fine, it's true. There are Uzbeks there, and there are Arab, what they call the Afghan Arabs. The Arabs who were brought in Afghanistan by the United States during the 1980s, when these Afghans were fighting against the Soviet occupation of their country, who helped them in their resistance against the Soviets. The Saudis, the Pakistanis, the British, and the United States. Today we talk about a long line of madrasas that are training militants, both inside Afghanistan as well as in Pakistan. And many people talk about the Saudis provided these funds to these madrasas, and in the United States, everyone, I mean, not only the journalists and the academics, but all the politicians, Vice President Joe Biden, our Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, everyone has become an expert on madrasa education. Everyone. They call it madrasas. Yeah. And then remember that secret memo written by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, in which he wrote to his colleagues that I don't know whether the number of militants that we are killing is the same as the number of militants being produced by the madrasas every day in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Okay, so the madrasas are now being described as the breeding ground of militancy, of radicalism, of terrorism, of jihadism. Somebody called them Jessica Stern of Harvard University. Again, that tells us how shallow is the Harvard education. Sorry. Any Harvard graduate? No. Thanks, thank God. She wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs in which she described the madrasa as jihad factories. And Jeffrey Goldberg wrote a piece in New York Times magazine talking about jihad universities, as if jihad is being taught. Okay, so everybody's blaming the Saudi. Saudi provided the fund. The Pakistani intelligence agency, ISI, Inter-Service Intelligence, they provided these training and all these things. And the truth of the matter is, if we want to know where does the key to the whole issue lie, it's not in Kabul, not in Islamabad, not in Riyadh. It's in Langley, Virginia. It's in Langley, Virginia. It was the CIA that provided the guidelines. Recently, the university, of all the universities in the world, in the United States, the Center of Afghan Studies is where? University of Omaha, Nebraska. I mean, how the midland of the heart of the United States, you have Center for Afghan Studies. Okay, anyway, there's a Center for Afghan Studies. During, in 1985, the USAID provided $25 million to the University of Omaha, Nebraska to prepare textbooks for the Afghan refugees' children. There were 5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Obviously, they had to be educated, their children. And many of them were very young. Many of them were born in Pakistan after their parents migrated to Pakistan during the Civil War against the Soviets. So, the madrasas or the schools were established. USAID gave a contract to University of Omaha, Nebraska to write the textbook for schools. I have seen the textbook, the primer, the where you teach alphabet. Mm-hmm. Aleph, Bay, ABC. Aleph is for Allah, fine with me. I'm a believing Muslim. But T is for tank, right? B is for blood. J is for jihad. K is for Kalashnikov. These were the textbooks that were produced by the funding provided by the U.S. government, by the State Department. And then we asked the question, where did the militants come from? How did we have a generation of such dedicated, militant, radicalized youth who know nothing about except Kalashnikov, blood, killing,
yeah,
jihad, and tanks, and S for Stinger, of course, because the Stinger missiles were provided by the CIA. So the key to the whole puzzle, it's in Langley, Virginia, not in Islamabad. Islamabad is only what's called, it's only picking up the pieces. It's only cleaning up the mess that was created by my country. Right now, the situation does not look very, very optimistic, very hopeful, as far as I can see. I think the militancy and the radicalism for the present generation is lost. The only thing we have to look forward is to save the next generation of young men and women in that part of the world, in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. The solution lies in education, in economic development, in the state taking up its responsibility seriously, providing social welfare, education, health, employment to the people. If you are in the northern areas of Pakistan as a young man, 18, 19 years old, no job, no employment, absolutely no future, and then one of the militant leaders approaches you and he says, I'll give you 10,000 rupees a month and here is the Kalashnikov, what you will do? You don't need to subscribe to his ideology. You need to earn something for your family, for yourself. The money gives you some resource that you can feed your family. The gun gives you a sense of power that you lack. That's the breeding ground for the recruitment. And we have to think about that. I think I should stop here. I apologize again for being very incoherent, unstructured. But again, you know, thank you very much.
You want to take some questions? I was just wondering, at what time did the CIA decide that they needed to train people in the madrasas and for what purpose?
Well, the CIA involvement officially began after the election of President Reagan, when Mr. Casey became the director of the CIA. That's 1981. Mm-hmm. But if you read some of the confessions, I would say confessions, by Brzezinski, who was the mm-hmm. National Security Council advisor of President Carter, mm-hmm. the process had started much earlier. Mm-hmm. In other words, the CIA involvement in Afghanistan situation started when the Soviets, not when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in December 1979, but at least 8 months before the Soviet invasion. In other words, in early 1979, after the Iranian Revolution. When the Iranian Revolution took place, that scared, I mean, that was probably the most serious setback for the American foreign policy in the entire region. And the United States had to worry about who and where they can have their excess strategic influence. Afghanistan was the next place to watch over what the Soviets are doing. So the U.S. intervention started in early 79. Mm-hmm. Then with the coming of President Reagan, what you call DD, that was the time when the new strategic thinking was introduced mm-hmm. under the Reagan administration. And that was to challenge the Soviets indirectly through proxy wars mm-hmm. all over the world. Mm-hmm. It was not only in Afghanistan. The Soviets were, in the perception of the Reagan administration, engaged in Nicaragua. They were engaged in Angola. They were engaged in Mozambique. So it was a worldwide movement on the part of the Reagan administration to challenge the Soviet and their hegemony and their influence. Mahmoud Mamdani, a Columbia professor, who, by the way, recently has published a wonderful book on Darfur. I think you should check out on Darfur. His wonderful book is called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. Ibrahim is familiar with that book. He essentially is arguing that that was the time when you see the emergence of international terrorist organizations. And these terrorist organizations challenging the pro-Soviet regimes in the Middle East, in Latin America, in Africa, and funded by the United States. Right? The Contra, for example, in Nicaragua. What were the Contras? A terrorist organization. The word terrorism probably at that time was not used. But the active participation of the CIA started in 1982-83, when the good time Charlie Wilson of Texas. Have anybody seen the movie Charlie's War?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we call it, he's known in the United States as Good Time Charlie. The Congressman Charles Wilson. Anyway, where he became, he mobilized the support in the U.S. Congress. A task force, Afghan task force, was established, joint task force consisting of the congressmen and the senators, and then the CIA actively started engaging. The British are also not very innocent. Margaret Thatcher supplied not only the intelligence, because the British have much smarter intelligence base about Afghanistan, because they know the Afghans well. They were defeated three times by the Afghans. In fact, one of the British generals who accompanied the American generals before the invasion, they were driving from Islamabad, from Rawalpindi to Peshawar, and he showed the British general, the brigadier, he showed the American general the graves of the British officers right and left on the GT road.
Yep.
Right from Rawalpindi up to Hasan Abdal and Wah. You could see those graves. He said, well, you're going into Afghanistan, but we also went there. You see, this is it. The British provided the intelligence base, and initially it was the British idea to provide this kind of jihadi orientation. And then the Americans jumped in. One thing that I need to say here is that it's not that jihad is not very important theological concept in Islam. It's very potent. It's very important. Mm-hmm. Both as a concept of moral rearmament, there was a movement called...
Yes, it's
movement.
Right.
Yes, yeah. As a moral force, as well as a defensive war. When you are attacked, you have a right to defend yourself. You have to resist the occupation. It's very potent. But jihad was a dormant concept. It was a dormant concept throughout the 20th century. It was the CIA that woke up this concept. It kind of started raising this idea of jihad. So the Taliban and Al-Qaeda should be grateful to the CIA for indoctrinating them into a concept that was almost had been forgotten. It was with the U.S. help that people went from one Muslim country to another to recruit the Arabs from Egypt, from Jordan, from Tunisia, from Morocco, and from so many other Middle Eastern countries to come and fight. The blind Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman, who is suffering the life sentence, was one of the persons who came to the United States, who came to New York, and the visa was provided by the CIA intervention. He was refused the visa by the U.S. Embassy, and then the CIA intervened and said, give him the visa. He came to New York in the 1980s, and he launched a movement for the recruitment of people from the United States to go and fight. So all the Arab Afghans and all these, ultimately, yes.
When you say that, you know, given the militarization that's occurred, that the present generation is lost in the northern regions of Pakistan, if I understood you correctly, or in Afghanistan, and I totally honor that what you're saying is very honest and very true. On the other hand, it just fills me with this enormous, sense of responsibility and deep sadness that a whole generation is lost in a certain way. These are mothers that are giving birth to children. These are fathers that love their children. These are uncles and aunts and so on that are or have been in this process of militarization. So when I look at what's happening right now and what's just hit the news in the last few days, with this law that apparently Karzai has endorsed, and there are those that say yes, his election in August is you know creating this need for him to do this. And at the same time, I'm thinking to myself as I sit in my kitchen in Camrose, Alberta, this is perfect. He's in a place where now there's this immense international rage. It seems like, what's he going to do now? Like, he seems to be between a rock and a hard place.
Exactly.
If he says, I've got to change it, those that he's tried to appease by creating an apparent agreement are going to be frustrated. And so my question to you, in the middle of all this that I've just said, what role do you see for those of us on the outside that care about all the suffering and the puzzlement and the being caught between a rock and a hard place that all of these mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and grandparents are in the middle of? What would your sense of what is our role internationally? What is our role as individuals? What is the role of those of you who have even closer contact and connection? I'm trying, without being falsely Pollyanna-ish, to see some hope or a way that the world can act in wisdom that they haven't up until now.
Well, first of all, as a good Lutheran, pray for us. And pray for Afghanistan. That's one thing. Fighting faith and prayer is going to help. But as we said, faith alone is not enough. Something else has to be done. International community has to pay attention to particularly the social and economic conditions in that part of the world. As many U.S., even General Petraeus said, there is no military solution in Afghanistan. And there is no military solution in Pakistan either. The military can do they can destroy, they can defeat, but they cannot heal the wounds. They cannot rebuild the country. I hope that Obama administration has realized, and I think there is going to be some change. Although I'm afraid that the war is going to be more Americanized now. When you send more American troops and about 2,000 more American civilian advisors, you are taking over Afghanistan. That is the danger that I see. Karzai is a puppet president. He his government does not extend outside the city of Kabul. Mm-hmm. And even that probably is an exaggeration. outside his presidential palace, his security guards are the American provided by the Blackwater. A president who cannot rely on his own countrymen for his safety and hires his security guards from a foreign country, what moral standing does he have to rule the country? But even now, of course, the U.S. government, I believe, is having second thoughts about the wisdom of keeping him. But the problem is, anyone else will be worse. And the old philosophy goes that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. The other, excuse me, not, I won't say devil, but another person who was being considered, and he himself harbored some ambition for that, is a good friend of mine, again from University of Chicago, the former ambassador to Afghanistan, to Iraq, and to the United Nations, Zalmay Khalilzad. We were classmates in Chicago as well as at American University in Beirut also. Zalmay was being considered by the Bush administration as the next candidate. And he was being encouraged. And he expressed also his own desire in a couple of places. But with the coming of the Democratic administration, I don't think anybody trusts him. So he's out. What can be done? There are no easy answers. I don't think anyone in Washington who knows what to do now. You invited yourself into a situation about which you had no strategic planning at all. And that's why the Pakistanis, the Afghans, the Americans, and even the NATO countries are just groping in the dark. And I hope they hit something that works. That's the only hope. Yes?
I want to ask if you're familiar with either two things. One is there was an article in the Edmonton Journal just a while ago about the government in the Edmonton Journal, our paper in it, about the work the government, that the Netherlands forces had done in strategic planning before using military. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with that. The other one, are you familiar with the work of Greg Mortensen in building schools in the the Northeast?
Wonderful person.
Yeah, and he, it seems that, you know, with this lady's question,
that's the hope. Yes.
About what can people like us do?
Yes.
It seems like he's a person who's given a model.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. That approach, I should have mentioned. I'm very glad. I'm grateful to you that you mentioned that. And I think the Canadians are very good at that. And the Dutch, of course, they are very good at planning. As I say, particularly about the future planning. And you know, in 1973, when there was oil embargo, the only country that didn't suffer at all during the oil embargo was Netherlands. Because the Dutch had already, about 5 years before that, they had drawn up different scenarios in which this scenario was exactly that they had planned for. What was the Dutch company? Dutch Shell?
So
they rode the storm most successfully. Similarly, I'm told, the Dutch approach in Afghanistan has been the best approach in terms of their public relations, their contact with the local communities. Unfortunately, the Canadians, proportionately, have suffered the most casualties, more than the Americans. And most of the Canadian presence has been essentially in military operations rather than in
development
and building. So if we can, if you can persuade your government to pay more attention to this other approach, building up schools, developing employment opportunities for the young men, that would be much more helpful.
Can I just follow up on that?
Sure.
A little bit. You talked about the schools having been created, really, in the curriculum by the AID and the CIA. But that was a while back. And those schools are now run by various people. Did in your study, did you see any kind of internal transformation that's taking place? Or are there ways of entering in to some kind of relationship with that system in order to, from the inside, transform the system a bit? How does that look?
You see, as a student of public administration, public policy, I know institutions have their own life.
Mm-hmm.
You establish an institution and you give it a goal. That goal is achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So the institution should have a sunset, right? Finished.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Santa Claus.
Look at the March of Dimes. Mm-hmm. Why this institution, March of Dimes, was, this charity was established? To fight the polio. The problem of polio has been solved long time ago. The March of Dimes is still there. Now they are fighting for some other disease. Right? Homeless children. So, once the institutions were established, then they take up their own momentum. They have their own life. Yesterday they were fighting the Soviets. The Soviets are gone. But they still have the manpower. They still have the four walls, the ceiling, the roof over their heads. And they're clash and cope. What are you going to do? You have to find a new enemy. And the new enemy is the United States. Because generally it is perceived in the minds of many Muslims as working against the interests of Muslims. In Palestine, in Kashmir, in this place and that place. So you divert your guns. Internal transformation. Now, there are two kinds of madrasas. Let me be very clear. I'm glad you asked this question. Overwhelming majority of the madrasas in Pakistan, in India, in Bangladesh, have absolutely nothing to do with militancy. The madrasas and the type of education that they provide, it is maybe outdated, it may be legalistic, it may be literalist, it may be very conservative, it may be very legalistic, but it is not militant, it is not radical, it is not terrorist oriented. Out of the 20 subjects that are taught in the madrasa, only 8 can be considered as religious. Quran, Hadith, the traditions of the Prophet, Fiqh, the jurisprudence, law, Tafsir, commentary of the Quran. And the rest of all the subjects are secular subjects. Grammar, prosody, rhetoric, mathematics, some medicine, traditional medicine.
They're not doing faith-based biology?
No science.
No science.
They used to teach, they still teach medicine from Avicenna's book.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. They're still from the same book. Anyway, so in the curriculum itself, in the mainstream madrasas, there is absolutely nothing that is even political, what to talk of radical. In fact, overwhelming majority of the madrasas consider politics as haram, as forbidden. The madrasa students used to be expelled from madrasas if they were seen reading the newspaper. Because it's too worldly. I mean, you have come here to study religion. You have nothing to do with what's going on in the rest of the world. You don't need to know. So the madrasas that are associated with the militancies, they were, let me put it that way, the madrasas that are associated with radicalism, with militancy, are not the ones that were madrasas where militancy was taught, but these were the institutions initially established to train the militants, and then in order to provide religious legitimacy, they were transformed into madrasas. You see? That's what happened. And these are the madrasas that are mostly confined at the northern part of Pakistan. On the Pakistan of Afghanistan part. Yes.
In that same Edmonton Journal yesterday, there was an article about 100 girls.
Seems to be very popular.
Very popular. 100 girls.
But the only thing we have access to. Sorry.
Yeah. Were raised last year, destroyed
yes.
by Taliban. So my question leads on to this hope for the future. How will that come about if education is not
available? Yeah. You see, for example, the Taliban, when they came into power in Afghanistan, they banned the women education. Not only the high school, but even the elementary right. schools. At that time, one of the representatives of the Taliban government who visited the United States in 2001, in February, just about a few months before September 11, he was the guest of the USAID, and the USAID was going to provide them $40 million as a gratitude to the Taliban for fighting against the poppy cultivation. Anyway, he was asked this question in Houston, Texas. Houston was a very popular stop by the Taliban. Why? Oil. Yes. Okay, so he was asked about the question, why have you banned women, girls' education? His answer was not that we are against the education of girls. He said, and probably it's just justification, I'm not justifying what he said, we are doing it temporarily because the law and order situation is not safe for girls to leave their homes. When the security situation improves, law and order situation improves, and the girls feel safe to leave their home, then we will open up the schools. That was his probably answer meant for the American media. I think essentially it was the Taliban mostly came from the tribal background. In tribal society, you don't need to teach your woman. That's in their perception because they don't need to know anything. You just teach them how to say their prayer. That's it. Period. So there's absolutely no tradition in the tribal rural society of education of women. So that was their primary. It had nothing to do with Islam. It had basically a reassertion of tribal values. The same thing that the Pakistani Taliban did during their insurgency during the last couple of years. Reportedly, they have built not one, how many? About 600 different schools, including the girls' schools. They have burnt it, destroyed them, detonated, blasted them. Now, recently, one of the spokesmen of the Taliban was asked this question, and his response again was very tactical. He said, we did not blow up these schools because we're against the women education. We blew up these schools because these schools were being used by the Pakistani military as their operation command headquarters. So therefore, we destroyed them so that the Pakistani military that was operating against us could not hide in them. That's again a lame excuse. However, after this agreement was signed between the Pakistani provincial government Northwest Frontier Government and the Pakistani Taliban. It's about a month ago, I think, there has been no such incident. And according to the official report, the statement by the provincial government of the NWFP, about 15 to 20% schools have reopened. Started.
Do you want to pursue that a little farther, Pat?
Well, along the lines of that, just in terms of allowing them to go to the schools, like they open the schools, but will women be allowed? I mean, there has been incidents, and I have been taught by professors not to trust the media very much, but after throwing incidents, I mean, really prohibitive things to stop them. So it's easy to say they're afraid to go, but who are they afraid of, and will that change?
Much of this has to do with the law and order situation, with the lack of security, with the lack of government, the collapse of the administrative system in Pakistan. If you rebuild the state institutions, strengthen the district administration, the political agent institution that used to exist, thanks to the British, I think this is... It's the same northern belt of Pakistan, same tribal belt, where for the last 60 years the female educational institutions existed, nobody bothered it. Nothing happened. So it means what we are seeing today is an abnormal situation. It's not normal. The normal situation is that the tribe, they didn't bother. I mean, you don't send your own daughter, that's another thing, but you don't prevent someone else's daughter. It never happened. I think it will go back to the same situation if the law and order is established. I saw a cartoon in one of the Afghan newspapers. It was reprinted in Pakistan, about the status of women, the state of women during the Taliban, before the Taliban, during the Taliban, then after the American came to power. By the way, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in November, if you go back and look at the U.S. media, newspapers, magazines, TV programs in October, you would see suddenly a great sympathy for the Afghan women. Right? And somebody suggested that Afghanistan is the only country in the world that was invaded by a foreign country to liberate women. Because President Bush and Laura Bush came on TV and she shed the tears about the plight of women in Afghanistan, and as if the US was going to Afghanistan only to liberate the Afghan women and no other motives. In fact, a couple of years ago, in 2000, when I saw a barrage of articles in the New Republic, in the commentary, in Weekly Standard, in Washington Post, in New York Times magazine, about the Iranian women, I became very scared. I said, Iran is going to be attacked. Yeah, because the whole, if you've seen Edward Said's Orientalism, that's very kind of thing. A Muslim woman enslaved in chain, and the white man going there to liberate him, kind of thing. That's very, very, sounds very great.
Chivalrous.
Exactly, chivalrous. Yeah,
it's also President Bush's long-standing attention to women's issues.
Yeah. Anyway, so the cartoon was that there was a caption, there were three frames. One frame was woman before the Taliban. And there's a man who is walking, and his wife is walking about 10 feet behind him. And somebody says, why you're walking behind your husband? She says, it's a custom. That's our tradition. Then the second frame was woman under the Taliban. And the man is still walking ahead, and his wife is walking 10 feet behind him. And somebody's asking her, and she says, while you're walking behind us, she says, it's Islamic law. And then the third frame, the woman is no longer wearing hijab. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's emancipated, huh? But she's still walking 10 feet. Woman under the American occupation, under Gaza. She's still walking 10 feet behind. And somebody asking, why you're walking? Yeah. She said, because if there is what's called improvised
landmine,
he's the one who will die. I want him to die. Yes, sir. That was your
question.
Mr. Osama bin Laden apparently had kidney problems several years ago and was ready to die. And Americans have been after him. How come he's still alive? Or is he still alive?
I have no idea. The Americans might have provided him with good dialysis. The Germans have good machine. Yes.
I don't want to overstate this point, but I just want to put it out here. Is there any hope for democracy in these countries as long as they retain the title Islamic Republic? You referred to the power of the religious authorities and how Bhutto as a secular person kowtowed. We're seeing with Afghanistan today, we're seeing elections coming up in Iran where the candidates have to be approved by the religious authorities. These are the Islamic republics.
Yeah.
And does a name in the, or in the title of the state, give the religious authorities some legitimacy? Or where do they get their legitimacy from that they can exercise it in this way and have such tremendous power? And I guess, you know, when I talk about democracy, I mean, Turkey is the only country that would be a democracy. I mean, Pakistan has tried with varying degrees of success, and others have, but they just haven't been successful in democracy. And maybe, now that's an important part of our culture. Maybe it's not important to, but... I don't see much.
I understand your concern. I would rather defer to Ibrahim, and I would request David to ask him to give a lecture on that. He has done enormous, tremendous work on this intellectual history, intellectual thought in Islam, particularly Islam and democracy. But I'll give you two very brief answers. When you said it's a part of our culture, we saw, in the Western culture, we had recent examples of fascism, totalitarianism. So it's not necessarily, it's only a part of very recent history of the West that democracy has been. Secondly, not all Muslim countries are authoritarian. That you yourself suggested Turkey, Malaysia is another one. Almost, you call it soft authoritarianism. Well, Malaysian example. But it's still a democracy. Almost 90% of the African Muslim countries are now democratic. When you talk about
non-functioning democracy,
it's a kind of
nominally,
the same we call it in the United States. It's not a perfect democracy. I can give you a lot of examples from my own country. I'm not being very kind of polemical, but the other thing is. Democracy is not, it's a process, okay? So almost every country in the world is leading towards democracy. It's not a kind of end stage that we have arrived. In our country, despite democracy, we had the Patriot Act, which is a fundamental violation of my civil liberties. Despite the mother of democracy in Great Britain, they had terrorism laws that probably, I recently hosted David Miliband, the foreign minister, and we were together in panel in Islamabad, and he admitted, he said, I'm not very proud of what we did, our parliament did. So what I'm trying to say is, even in Western democracy, you have some moments where you abandon your commitment to democracy for other reasons. The Muslim countries, many of them, have come out of the experience of colonialism. They are groping their ways into that. Some of them are successful, some of them are not very successful. But there is nothing inherently contradictory between Islam and democracy. Because we are familiar with the same debate only about 25, 30 years ago about the Latin American countries. How can these Catholics be Democrats? They can never be a democracy in Catholic societies. I'm a student of political science. When we went to the graduate school, we read the literature, the entire culturalist argument. What was the culturalist argument? There is something inherently undemocratic in Catholicism. That's why you have Portugal, you have Spain, you have fascism in Spain, you have Portugal dictatorship, all these kind of Central European countries, all these Latin American countries. The same debate is now being Islam and democracy.
And you haven't even mentioned Israel.
Of course, yeah. No, we can't mention it.
Which is another.
In the polite camp. Yes.
Another question. Has any work been done on that border that is not appropriate, not effective, not realistic? Has anybody gotten together and said, there's got to be another solution here, let's look for it?
The Pakistani government during Musharraf, when Musharraf was the president, he proposed one thing. He said, the Israeli option, build a wall, what's called the barbed wire. He said, barbed wire, the whole border, and then the Americans will not complain that we are letting the militants cross the border into Afghanistan who are fighting against the United States and NATO. But who opposed it? The Afghan government. They said, we will never accept that. Why? Because building a barbed wire means
there is a border.
Defining the border, accepting the international boundaries, and the Afghan government doesn't want it. Then the United Nations also intervened, and the UN said, no, it's against humanitarian kind of thing, because you have tribes living on this side, living on that side. And thirdly, if you see, probably, I can't remember some good documentary about Afghanistan, but if you see some that terrain, you'll understand that it's impossible to draw anything. I mean, it's
okay. A wall is one option, but surely there are other options of redrawing the boundary, or something that's more in relation to the people groups that live.
Yeah. Well. Probably it will not be acceptable to the Pakistanis because they don't want to cede sovereignty over the entire northern areas. It's a very sensitive area. First, it's on this side, on the northwest side, it borders India, so it provides some strategic depth to Pakistan. Secondly, borders China. Mm-hmm. That's also very important for Pakistan. They don't want to surrender the whole area. And say, okay, you take it. And of course, some of them would say, well, fine, we'll get rid of this headache once for all. But then, of course, these border areas are also strategic asset for Pakistan. Not only is this. In 1948, when the Pakistanis fought a war in Kashmir, most of the volunteers came from the northern areas to fight on behalf of Pakistan. They have been very patriotic, quote-unquote, Pakistanis from that point of view. So the Pakistanis also consider these tribal people, today they are fighting against the Pakistani state because they perceive that the Pakistani state is cooperating with the United States. They are not angry with the Pakistani state for its own reasons, but only because they think that it's collaborating with the U.S. that is occupying Afghanistan. Once this is settled, then they will live as normal Pakistanis. But there's one other thing that has to be taken into consideration about those areas. These tribal areas have never been under the administration of the Pakistani government. Pakistan army never entered these areas as a part of the pact that was signed between them and the Pakistani state in 1947. So this is the first time that Pakistani military has entered those areas.
So it's within the boundary,
within the
but
boundary.
Not under the authority.
Exactly, yes.
Alan, and I think we may finish with this, and I'll invite you for some juice and to continue the discussion informally.
At some point, the foreign troops are likely to leave Afghanistan. We don't know when, and maybe it'll be longer, but maybe it won't be as long as now we think. Do you think that at that point, or I know it's very difficult to say, but do you think it's likely that a very militant type of authority would return to Afghanistan, such as the Taliban, or a similar type of group?
Some of the surveys that were done by some international polling organizations indicate that overwhelming majority of the people in Afghanistan, they reject the Taliban. They do not want to go back to those people, that era when the Taliban were ruling. Like most people, the Afghans also want to live their life peacefully, raise their families, and do not want to be bothered. Whether it's oppressive laws in the name of Islam or whatever. So my feeling is that the impetus that many of the militants that they receive in the presence of the foreign troops will be gone. Once it's gone, that motivation will not be there. Afghanistan is not a natural one-nation state. It consists of different ethnic groups. Uzbeks, Tajiks, Pashtuns, Hazaras, some Turkmans. They have lived independently, autonomously within their own regions. So the project of Bush administration to establish a centralized authority in Kabul and unite one nation, that was not feasible in the beginning and that will not be feasible in the future. So if we accept the reality of Afghanistan's situation and work from that ground reality, then there is a possibility that peace can be restored. When the troops will leave, I happen to know the general who is commanding the U.S. troops there in Afghanistan, and now he has been appointed the commander of all the NATO troops. He said maybe a decade. And then he added, it's very optimistic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You sure can.